Okay, we are just in time starting this second series of symposia, and I don't know if everybody, I think that all people know all people, but many of them quite well. My name is Arjan Braam, psychiatrist in the Netherlands, and also involved in scientific committee, and they asked me to be a moderator this afternoon. It happens also that I should do 5 minutes talking as a presenter, but don't notice, I will share or take another coat. We have 4 contributions, and we will need all time, and I think you are ready to start. The team from Edinburgh, and the others are all Dutch, but seemingly Dutch, because Dr. Walton is not entirely Dutch. He will explain it perhaps in one of his minutes. So please go ahead, introduce your work, and we are ready to discuss it with you.
Close. Thanks, Ian. By way of introduction, then, this is our overview slide of where we hope to go with this session this afternoon. So, first of all, who we are and what we did. My name is Ian Telfer, and I am a member of the spiritual care team based in the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh, which is one of the main acute hospitals in Edinburgh.
And I am Professor Austin Snowden, Chair in Mental Health at the University of the West of Scotland, Director of Snowden and Snowden, and the numbers guy on this particular study. Although we are, I don't know if you know BBC comedy at all, but we do act as the two Ronnies. So we complement each other very nicely, don't we?
Sometimes.
I think you're very funny, for example.
Sometimes.
Thanks, Martin. So, what we propose to do is look at the initial study that this presentation is based on, give you some of the conclusions and recommendations that follow from that, and then point you in the direction where we hope to go from today, at least from this first study. So, first of all, what is a PROM? It is a patient-reported outcome measure, which in itself is a series of structured questions that ask patients about their health from their point of view, and that's the crucial thing. This is in order to get feedback from patients, and this began, I think, about the saying in hip surgery, in orthopaedics. So patients were being asked to give constructive feedback on the effectiveness of orthopaedic surgery. And it's now been embraced by various disciplines over the last few years in the UK, and this particular problem that we're looking at is the putting together of a questionnaire which will invite people to say from their point of view, as it says here, what the effectiveness of our spiritual care intervention has been. The context from which this comes is that in the UK all NHS employees are required to provide economically sound, evidence-based care. And in Scotland in particular, where health is what's called a devolved area of responsibility for the Scottish Parliament, the Health Quality Strategy for Scotland embraces this aim. What was our goal? The original goal was given to us by NHS Education for Scotland. Ewan, can you just quickly just put into a word from your perspective what NHS Education for Scotland is?
NHS Education for Scotland provides educational resources for all healthcare employees in Scotland. So it would work with universities in developing undergraduate curriculum. We would then be responsible for all the postgraduate development of all healthcare employees, from dentists to family doctors to chaplains to nurses.
So from that background, we were instructed to develop or invited to develop a tool for use in particularly a Scottish context that would show the impact of healthcare chaplaincy on patient well-being. And from the literature review that we did, and from discussions with colleagues both in the States particularly and at home, we came up with these 4 areas: demographics, what people felt during the encounter with the chaplain, how they felt afterwards, and in an invitation to describe how they felt now at the point of when they were filling in the questionnaire. Okay.
So just to go back, if I can, for a second, these are all themes that we gain from the literature and iteratively over a series of focus groups to enhance space and content validity, just to put that in context, so that we didn't just arrive at these. I don't know, excuse me, Ian, for clarifying.
No, absolutely right.
You know, this took us about a year to get to these particular aspects. This is the actual outcome measure, this part here. This is what happened during the encounter, and we wanted to get that information so that we could then see if there were any associations between that part, how the chaplain actually was, and then how people were after the encounter, so the outcomes. This aspect was because people wanted some sort of measure of how religious, spiritual people were, so that we can see what sort of people actually benefit from the encounter in the first place. So the process was the chaplain completed a referral record. Now this was just the chaplain's own record of what had actually happened, so that we could then associate that with the responses that the people gave back to see if they correlated. Then the patient completed the Lothian prompt, and then we analysed the responses. And just to summarise, this is our... we gave the prompt out to 70 people, 39 people responded. And if I can just break that down for you, we did the prompt in acute paediatric and mental health services. The majority of them were acute. Most people were really quite young, who were under 55. I say that as being young because I'm also under 55. Yeah, honestly. So the time in hospital, people were mainly really quite acute, short stay people, and the majority were female. I suppose the thing to note is it was a good response rate. It was above 50%, nearly 60%. What the responses showed was that there were associations between what happened during the encounter and the measures of outcome. So the key one, there were associations between all of these measures, but the key important one was that being able to talk during the encounter was associated with all of our outcome measures. So just the act of being able to talk during a session was significantly associated, even in this small sample, with all of the outcome measures. Likewise, in terms of what sort of people benefit from chaplaincy intervention, the statements that describe me now, all the spiritual ones, spiritual person, believing God, being religious, were not associated in terms of who benefited from the encounter. In other words, everybody benefited from it, whether religious or not. Okay, so that's what we got. Is that clear? I haven't given you any numbers because we haven't really got the time, but we also had a free text component, so the actual just back to this, there was a fourth part to this. So after we'd filled this in, there was also just a free text component, and the free text component just asked people to say a little bit about the encounter. So we ended up with some narrative data as well, and what that narrative data showed us was that people were talking about four consistent themes coming out from the data. They talked about the skills of the chaplain. They talked about whether religion and spirituality was important or not, and we've heard a lot about that in the sessions that I've seen in the conference. They talked specifically about chaplains delivering needs that other people could not meet, which was a key for, I think that was a really key point that Jung was particularly interested in. And in terms of outcome, people always, we ended up calling it a peaceful resolution to a horrible time. So that was the final outcome for people. And Ian's now going to just talk about a case study which illustrates all these components.
Okay. So this is one particular case that we featured in the report following the project. So it's a female patient in intensive care. Following the premature birth of a baby girl, the patient is now dying of a previous cancer for which she had declined treatment because she was pregnant. The patient's partner was referred by the staff nurse in intensive care due to worries over child custody, because there had been nothing set down legally about the father being father of the child. And so he was particularly worried at that time about whether or not he would end up with custody of the child, because one of the sisters of the lady who was dying was very forceful, and that he and she didn't have a particularly good relationship, and she was making noises about what should happen now to the baby. There was a very satisfactory series of conversations with the partner regarding procedures for determining custody, and that side of things was dealt with in a very satisfactory way. But that in itself led to an outpouring of emotion in relation to his partner's illness and her imminent death, and also visiting arrangements with other family members. So there was a lot of work went on in the background facilitating visiting between himself and his partner's sisters and her parents. And in these sessions, the time that the chaplain spent with this family, a lot of time was offered to the partner, to the partner's family, giving them support as well, working, as I say, behind the scenes, liaising between the partner, the family members and staff, and arranging, particularly in the last day, allowing for the child, the baby, to be brought over from the neonatal unit, to be in the room with the mother and the father, and for them to have this, the only family time they would ever have together before she died. And the feedback we got was that the chaplain was incredibly helpful in ensuring that I was able to have those final moments with my partner, that I could say all I needed to say without later regret of missing the moment. I do not follow any faith that immediately transpired to be irrelevant anyway, and I'm indebted to his help and wonder how I might ever have survived without it. It's a vital service which is a must in that most gruesome environment of the intensive care ward. So, we're talking about chaplain skills. The chaplain was incredibly helpful. Religion and spirituality in this particular case, as Austin was indicating a moment ago, there was no particular correlation in the study as a whole, and this particular individual didn't follow any particular faith path. But that was irrelevant from his point of view in terms of the support he felt he received from the chaplain. Unmet needs, a vital service in that particular environment of intensive care. And as far as this particular person is concerned, a huge sense of relief and indebtedness, and wondering how, without that support, he would have managed to go through the situation. It's interesting to note as well that the chaplain was involved afterwards, because the child was eventually transferred for prolonged care and some surgery in the children's hospital, and the chaplain was able to follow up and maintain that support there. So we should have said at the very beginning, that in the little map that came up at the beginning, Lothian stands for the health board area within which our study took place. Scotland has 13 health board areas,
yeah.
And NHS Lothian is the Edinburgh area, geographical area around the capital. So the Lothian PROM findings showed the lack of correlation between PROM outcomes, spiritual religious traits, means that chaplains were useful for all the sample. The importance of chaplaincy input was clear, sense of peace being a good outcome, being able to talk, as Austin's already said, was vitally important, and the use of a PROM can measure the impact of chaplaincy. So what next? Would the findings of the Lothian PROM hold in a larger sample? What improvements would we need to make? Would it be feasible to carry out a similar project covering all the other NHS Scotland boards, and how might this be done? So,
is this me?
It's you.
Okay. So the goal of the ongoing project, to which, if you're interested, we've got a long story about ethics submissions to tell you about. We've been trying to get this study through ethics in the UK for nearly 2 years now, which is an entire presentation in itself. But our hope is to establish if the findings that we've already got hold in a national sample and see if this PROM is a useful measure of patient outcome following chaplaincy intervention in a national sample of people attending community chaplaincy listening. So we're going national and we're going specific at the same time. The reason for that is the Ethics Committee wouldn't let us do it in the acute areas that we did the previous study in. See if you can get any logic out of that. But our objectives are to investigate the manner in which the Scottish PROM supports spiritual care for people in community chaplaincy listening, to establish the reliability of the Scottish PROM. The Lothian PROM was had a good Cronbach's alpha of about 0.8, I think. I can't exactly remember, but it was nice and reliable. So we're hoping that in this larger sample that will hold. We're also testing the convergent validity of the Scottish PROM against a well-validated well-being measure. We chose the Warwick and Edinburgh mental well-being scale because it's not to do with spirituality per se, it's just a measure of well-being, and because of the previous findings suggesting that chaplaincy outcomes were positive for everybody, we wanted to stay away from the religious element of well-being and just use a generalised measure. So if there is a convergent validity with the Warwick at Edinburgh, then it will suggest that the PROM is useful and measuring something of value to people broadly. We also want to establish the relationship between the self-reported chaplain efficacy scores and Scottish PROM scores. What we haven't had time to tell you about in any detail is that the chaplains' reports of what they thought the encounters were like were incredibly similar to the patients' reports of what they thought the outcomes were like, which suggests that chaplains have a really good idea of what they're actually dealing with. So we wanted to expand that into the next study. And that might seem very straightforward to anybody here who's a chaplain, but to people who are not, such as myself, trying to teach nurses to get into that space, it's actually really quite a valuable finding. And then finally, to make recommendations for the improvement of spiritual care services and chaplains' professional development. I don't know how many of you remember Ewan's talk yesterday, but he was talking about values-based reflective practice. The value of this is actually as a reflective tool, I think. I think it would support clinical supervision, as I understand it. And getting robust, valid evidence for the impact of chaplaincy will surely improve the value of values-based reflective practice.
Ooh, and that's just a photograph of where I come from. But deliberately, the northeast of Scotland, it's Aberdeenshire, and that's a 7 o'clock in the morning photograph as you head off in a hot air balloon up into the sky.
As you get out of
there's an up, up and away feeling about this whole project, and that's the reason for putting the photograph on. And if we get ethics permission, I think we've got something here.
One day,
that's right. We have got something here that will, we hope, enhance the service and enhance patient well-being.
Oh, yeah. More info.
Is someone willing to raise a question? Yes, please.
I wondered if you think there might also be a risk in measuring outcome of pastoral care, because when you do that, maybe the expectation is afterwards that you should always do things that help and you shouldn't do anything anymore, which is not proven. Isn't that a risk?
Important question.
Can I have a bash at that first, and then you're being the chaplain? Yeah. From my research head, I can see that that's a risk. But the reason I mentioned the values-based reflective practice is how you then use that tool. And so that sort of role is perhaps more for Ewan as to how we actually use it in practice. I see it as to support that sort of discussion, not to necessarily be prescriptive about what should and shouldn't be done, but to support that discussion. So I would hope that that's the way it would go. But I take your point. I think it's a fair point. Chaplaincy by tick box is not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to support a deeper investigation of it. I support research in that manner, but I can see that other people might just think, well, I'm not doing that. So, and we face a lot of those questions, don't we?
Do you agree this is awesome?
Absolutely. Okay. I don't want to take up any more time. Yeah.
Is it only these five questions? These five
yes.
Items?
Yes.
Yep. And you make one skill?
Yes.
That's a nice brief, isn't
it? Yeah.
Any other questions?
Well, I was wondering, being able to talk was the most important finding. Does that finding have implications for spiritual e-health, to your opinion? Because that's
e-health.
Because is it the talking or is it the attention or your?
Well, we haven't. I have to just go back to the slide. I'm trying to go as fast as I can. That's a good question. You know, if being able to talk, I won't go any further than that. You know, this being listened to wasn't.
No.
Okay. It was. No, don't get me wrong. It was associated with one or two, and I can't for the life of me remember which they were. Yeah. But being able to talk was associated with all of them.
Yeah.
And so there's something different about just being able to express yourself to someone and have the space to be able to do that, which was more important to this group of people than being listened to.
Yep.
So,
any other question? It's a bit discouraging for
I don't think so.
Okay, one last remark.
Can I just say how important politically this bit of work has been for Scottish chaplaincy? Politically, it has raised the profile, even the fact that these guys have been doing this bit of work and how difficult it has been, the journey, that this has raised the profile amongst other disciplines and with people who have money within our system.
Yes. Just measuring and sound thought.
Absolutely,
we do a lot of work for managers.
Yeah,
okay, we have to...
Thank you very much, James.
Meanwhile, I introduce Martin, who is a theologian and also has a lot of experience in this field of care in a mental hospital. Now you're bound to the university in Groningen.
Right.
And you will show some more details about yourself. Please go ahead.
Okay. My question is a little different, not looking at the effects of chaplaincy care, but looking at the interpretation that patients, client in the psychiatric care had a chaplaincy. What do they think the chaplaincy is? That was my question. So I got a little different feedback, but they did tell me what the effects of that chaplaincy were, even though that was not the primary question. This is one quotation of what one of Mary said, and it's really quite a striking, remarkable expression, but it sort of fits the results of the research. An opportunity, a chance, he said, chaplaincy care is an opportunity, a chance to better assess your own humanity, to take your life to a new level. I thought that was very strongly put. So, my research question is, how do clients in psychiatric treatment receive, interpret, and evaluate chaplaincy care? And my motivation was that there's a reasonable amount of research with self-reporting by chaplains. Most of the research that I was reading when I started about among patients and clients was quantitative satisfaction questionnaires, and there was a little limited amount of qualitative research among clients. My points of interest, what is their general experience with chaplains, the interaction, what are the topics, the domain that they're talking about, how did the course of conversation go, or the course of the contact, what is the relation to psychiatric treatment, and did religious or worldview identity play a role? And then the method, literature, survey studies, semi-structured interviews, focus groups, groups I wrote in Dutch, I see. excuses for that. And then coding the interviews, analyzing, comparing, and concluding. That was the basic way I went about it. I talked to 27 patients in psychiatric care from 6 different institutions with a geographic spread over the eastern part of the Netherlands. I was able to use 24 of the interviews. Most of them came from long-term psychiatric care, and most of the largest group was between about 35 and 50 years of age. Under 35, there was an underrepresentation, and there were also some other patients. So what does chaplaincy care about? The first thing that... this is now my interpretation of the interpretation of the client. That chaplaincy is more than presence or empathy alone. It was very important for them to be listened to be for people to talk to, and the empathy and the ability of chaplains to listen was rated very high by the clients, but they said it has to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about the meaning of life. We're getting deeper into questions, spirituality, religion. Not specifically religion, mostly the whole breadth of human life and the meaning that we find in that. So a lot of chaplains in the Netherlands like to say, you know, we're good listeners, we're very empathetic. But in the interviews, it's clear that the listening qualities are tied to specific topics that have to do with the meaning of life. Secondly, it's more than spirituality alone. And that's a rather provocative statement in the conference on religion and spirituality. But I mean by that, if I look at the discourses of what the clients are talking about, they're talking about spirituality, meaning, and purpose. But sometimes it's just very much their own identity. And very often, more than I would ever have expected, they're saying that their human dignity, their basic humanity was affirmed by the chaplain. And it's a different discourse in the interviews than the discourse of humanity. And the identity is also a different discourse. So it's sort of a discourse analysis of interview material. It's questionable because it's my interpretation of what they're saying, but at least the aspect of the affirmation of basic questions of meaning in life and basic humanity, human dignity, was a very strong item, much more than I had expected. And it's more than counseling or reflecting alone. They were referring to the former presentation, it was important for them to be able to talk about the situation, but they expected input from the counselors. Some sort of response, some sort of additional information, or additional perspectives, alternative perspectives on their situation, or even retort. Someone said, I need someone who says, oh, where are you going with this? And what was very interesting, the spatial metaphors, well, this goes a lot deeper. This brings your life to a higher level. This is the whole breadth of life instead of just the narrow psychiatric treatment. And also the dimension of time, I've known this chaplain longer than I've known any of the psychiatrists or the nurses, and that's a very important aspect to me. So this is actually the basic results of what chaplaincy care was to the patients. But I can say maybe two other things. One was interesting, the relation to treatment, psychiatric treatment. Someone says treatment is a form of care on its own. I have spiritual, religious needs. I want to talk about my life, and I just need someone to talk to about that. Often they had no particular relationship to a church or other organization, and the chaplain was the person who they talked to about their life. But they also said, well, it's help in relating to my disorder or my crisis. What does it mean to me that I've been depressed on and off all my life? How do I look at myself? How do I value myself? Some of them said more or less the same thing, but specifically related to their psychiatric treatment is sort of a complement to my therapy. You know, I'm trying to get back on my feet, but I need to understand what this loss means to me. And they would talk to specifically to the chaplain about their grief and about working through that. Some of them said it's even a part of my therapy. It's very interesting. Someone said, well, it's just a kind of therapy, chaplaincy. Why? Because it helps you. And others would say, no, it's very different from therapy because you're talking about different things. So it was very, very mixed evaluation whether chaplaincy belonged to therapy or not, depending on how it was put. Some of them say, well, I have these goals with my psychiatrist or with the nurse practitioner, and I think, you know, I want to talk to you about that. It has to do with my self-esteem. It has to do with the way I'm looking at my life, or things that have had to do with my religious life previously. But talking to the chaplain is part of the therapy. It helps. It's a complement. Not just a complement, but it's part of the therapy. And, very interesting, they said, it helps me relate to the therapy and the treatment. And that could be that they were having a fight with their psychiatrist and they needed to someone to talk about. But it could be that they were thinking, what does it mean to me to be in therapy? What does it mean to be a patient all of my life? What does it mean to live on the grounds of a psychiatric institution? And so it would help them to relate to their therapy, their treatment, or their stay there. Then, what were the results of chaplaincy care for the patients? And I was struck by the great amounts of things they said. And this is, I left out a couple of items even. It has to do with, it affects their emotions, their inner attitudes, the calmness. There's a word in there, I'm not sure what it means. Oh, less fear should be. Relief, courage, self-acceptance, or acceptance of their situation. Had to do with their feeling of recognition, recognition of their pain, recognition of their struggle, but also recognition, this is a person who recognizes that I'm a human being just like everyone else. Cognitions, specific insights, clarification of situations, practical wisdom that the chaplain had offered them. Related to specific situations, the chaplain gave me advice, he gave me a retort when I was going out too far on something. Existential and spiritual experiences, you might separate these, but trust, comfort, freedom, growth, reconciliation, those are things I experienced in contact with the chaplains. Aesthetic experiences, reading poetry. One client said, I thought that was very interesting, I talked to the chaplain a few times and then I could listen to music again. That was a very touching way of putting things. Ethical aspects, and this is interesting, these are not things, sympathy and respect are not something, just something they received from the chaplain, but it's something they learned in conversation with the chaplain and in groups that the chaplains were leading. I learned to sympathize with other people. I learned to have respect for other religions. A big emphasis on identity, the empowerment of their own identity, of centering in who they are as a person, being seen and heard. Therapeutic effects, some of them said very clearly, chaplaincy contributed to my healing. And then, survival, saved my life. I was struck with 24 patients that about a third of them started talking about how the chaplain had helped them to stay alive. Or they say maybe that wasn't that, maybe that's putting it too strongly, but well, maybe not. And so in analyzing those statements, I realized that they weren't just talking about survival. That's what they started talking about. But they were really talking about vitality. And then I started looking back at the issues of spirituality, identity, humanity. And it occurred to me that the Hebrew word nefesh has to do with person, has to do with spirit, it has to do with vitality, it has to do with spirit. And actually that it was very interesting that actually the translation range of the Hebrew word nefesh, that is often translated as soul, covered the three strands of identity, spirituality, and humanity that I had discovered earlier. And that had to do, and I arrived at that by thinking, well, these people are saying the chaplain saved my life, and what they meant was, I think, the chaplain helped me rediscover my own vitality in life. And then, it has to do with the spirit, one of the clients said. And the spirit blows where it wants to. It's a reference to John 3, but it's also a reference to a poem that the patient had read. And like I say, despite all the norms, values, and traumatic experience, the spirit still blows in one direction or another. And that promises freedom. And this was at the end of the last interview I held, and it was very striking. Wendy thanked me that I was doing this work, because if she could do anything for all the chaplains who had helped her, she was glad to do that. But she placed the experience that she had with Chaplin very strong in the context of her personal, maybe even human, freedom. And she did that with a metaphor of the wind that blows where it wants. And the poem that she was referring to was kind of ominous, because you never know what's going to happen with your human spirit. It could get sick, it could get better. But for her, because she had been sick so long, it was sort of the hope that maybe things could turn for the better, that there was some promise of getting better and of freedom. Thank you very much.
Martin, please stay because I have questions. And I introduced you from the wrong university. There will be other people from the Groningen University. You are based in Groningen for the Protestant University, so that's completely different.
we work together.
No.
Sometimes.
Other questions? Other questions for Martin? Again, this touches to the point you are making, that how important it can be for the Dutch society and the community of people working chaplaincy to make clear what you're actually doing. How do you view to that point? Are you expecting reactions, responses from the field?
I'm hoping for that. Actually, this is a little prior stage than like the proms, which is more of a measurement, and that can be used to develop statistical evidence. And this is interpretive evidence. I mean, it is evidence, and it's what patients or clients are reporting, and I think that's significant, and I think it does give a picture. But it could either be used or it could be used to complement or used to for further research that might become more statistical. It just depends on what the people want who are looking for the evidence. What kind of evidence?
You want to comment on it or raise a question?
Yes, I want to ask something. That's how you selected the clients. Which clients did you interview?
Yeah. I first wrote client councils at various hospitals and asked them if they would select clients for me. And that worked for about a third, or at least a third of the clients. And then the client council didn't really know what to do with the question. They referred me to the chaplaincy services. So that was a little disappointment. But then I decided to go ahead and go with the chaplaincy departments, because I was not looking at whether the clients were satisfied. If that was the question, then I couldn't have worked that way. But I was looking at the interpretation they were giving of it, and what chaplaincy meant to them, and what they thought the good chaplaincy was. And even not in a moral sense of good chaplaincy, but this is what chaplaincy is about. And so the last two-thirds of the clients that I approached were approached by chaplains. But I looked, I could not discover any significant differences between the first third of the interviews and the second, two-thirds of the interviews.
Was it difficult to find people wanting to take part in this?
No, it was not difficult to find people, mm-hmm. But it was difficult for the client counselors didn't really... I don't know why, but I had no leverage to say, come on and do it. So that's the way I finally ended up working.
Okay. I think we almost have to go on, but your question we kind of missed. So,
comment, Martin. I don't know about in parts of the world, but in Scotland or in the UK, chaplains can't actually decide together what they do. They can't actually define their role. And it's actually fantastic to hear from patients that mm-hmm. chaplains help me to rediscover my vitality.
Okay.
Brilliant. So thank you.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
The next speaker is, she seems to be alone, Hanneke Schaap-Jonker, a psychologist of religion from Groningen, Netherlands. In fact, they've turned the three people up, including myself, so I... You will explain everything to us. Just go on, just behind Skip.
Okay, I'll try. Okay, good afternoon. We will present two different studies on code reputations and personality, which we performed in the Netherlands. The first study will be presented by Arjan Braam, and the second, Nathan and I cooperate, and we will both present part of it. Our focus is on code representations, because that's a core aspect of religiousness. We all know that religion and spirituality can be defined along numerous dimensions in multiple ways. And this operationalization focuses on the meaning which God or the divine has to a person, or in other words, the mental representations of his or her personal God. In the Netherlands, but also in Belgium, United Kingdom, Germany and United States, the question of God representations has frequently been used. And this is a self-report instrument which covers two dimensions, feelings towards God, positive feelings, anxiety or anger, and beliefs on God's actions, so supportive actions, ruling, punishing actions, or passivity of God, so then God's doing nothing. So in fact, the QGR consists of six skills, and in this way the list functions as an operation of relational view that understands God representations as comprising both an emotional part, so your heart knowledge, relationship towards God or divine, and a cognitive part, so your head knowledge, so experiential and doctrinal representations. And from a relational theoretical perspective, God representations are related to internal representations of significant others and to self-representations. And these representations function as building blocks of personality, resulting in patterns of rigid or flexible behavior, which may also parallel or influence personality traits. Therefore, multiple studies have addressed the associations between personality and code representation, or between personality pathology and code representation. And as I said before, we would like to present you two recent studies from the Netherlands. The first one is from Arjan Braam. He conducted it among elders and investigates the relationship between personality traits, God representation, religious coping and depression. The second study was performed among psychiatric patients and individuals belonging to the general population. And in that study we were not only interested into separate aspects of God representations in relation to personality, but also to God representation clusters or profiles, in which distinct aspects of God representations are only meaningful in combination with other aspects, so the total profile of the cognitive space. To you, first study.
Thank you, Anneke. It's over here. Oh, I have many connections in the Netherlands, so I've shown them now for you. Also, the University of Humanist Studies. I generally work with a data set which was collected in Amsterdam, the longitudinal aging study Amsterdam, which is a nationwide study in three regions at least, around Amsterdam, around Zwolle, here in the east and in the south, small, more Catholic regions. So that is a national sample of older people followed since 1992. And this study is ongoing. Many older people have died meanwhile, but we have lots of data because we visit them every 3 years, and that study is on many topics, not only on religion. That is only a very small part of this big study, with meanwhile over 400 international publications. I focused on depression, depressive symptoms measured every 3 years in this sample, and in 2005 I was able to put an extra questionnaire about the, including the questionnaire image of God or God representation. Yeah.
In the Netherlands, that's the same word in Dutch.
Word the image of God.
That's a theological experience of things. So I focused on God representation and religious coping. Thanks for changing the words. Between 1992 and 2005, I distinguished five types of patterns of depressive symptoms. People who never had depressive symptoms according to the instrument we used, the CESD scale. People who recovered from high levels of depressive symptoms. People who had a sort of episode or more episodes but no longer having them at the last assessment. People have ongoing depressive symptoms at previous assessment at least, and also currently, or people who have them currently only. So this is not an official typology, but the data allowed us to make several types of course or course trajectories, you could say. And I'm willing to look to the patterns of these courses, how they relate to the measurement of the God representation and religious coping. The sample is just an older Dutch sample. After so many years of interviewing the people at an age of 77, we have a very normal distribution of non-church members, Protestants and Roman Catholic. That is, for this age, quite normal, with a weekly church attendance rate of 33%. And I just want to show you some items of this questionnaire God image, questionnaire God representations. I show you the items I used from a slightly shorter version perhaps than you have, with positive feelings towards God, and the question, the items that when I think about God I experience thankfulness. A second item is when I think about God I experience proximity, etc. So a very simple inviting question, I would say, and it has this positive feelings towards God, has a very strong internal consistency. Another skill is about fear of God. You see a few of the items when I think about God I experience, for example, guilt or shame, and the negative feelings, other negative feelings like anger towards God. I call them feeling wronged by God. I use the translator for that. I paid the translator to get the term feeling wronged by God, such as when I think about God I experience disappointment. Also a good skill. Furthermore, I use the positive religious coping skill, one of the short versions by Kenneth Pargament, and the negative religious coping skill, the brief are cope, negative and positive, with a few items. And here we see the patterns of answering on these scales. Positive feelings towards God are more prevalent than negative types of feelings, and positive religious coping is more prevalent than negative religious coping, which is similar to studies in the US. I wrote a paper on the five-factor model of personality and associations between these religious measures. And here are the results with NEOAC, meaning neuroticism, extroversion, openness, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. And we see, I think, four or five relevant associations in a small test sample in the township of Sassenheim, in the middle of the Bulb region, where I found that the fear of God was associated with neuroticism and feeling wronged by God as well. Feeling, having the idea that God is a ruling or punishing type of guy was negatively associated with openness, and the personality characteristic of agreeableness was associated with experiencing God as supportive, and but I just added it was also associated with prayer. These associations were adjusted for depressive symptoms. I think they're quite they're the net associations. Then a new paper is on the 12-year history of late life depression with these types of course I already explained to you, and here we have the odds ratios of having high scores on positive feelings towards God, fear towards God, or feeling wronged by God. And the problematic type of course I showed to you of recent and current depression was quite strongly associated with feeling wronged by God and fear of God. And also the same pattern was visible for current or recurrent depression. similar associations exist, very similar associations existed for negative religious coping, also associated with recent and current, but also to previous depressions. So I made a little model about attachment style, with insecure attachment styles perhaps associated to neuroticism or affective instability, or whatever you would call it, making people prone to depressive episodes, and perhaps having a similar source, the negative God representations being sourced in an insecure attachment style. But then I thought, well, let's adjust for effects of neuroticism. A measure of neuroticism applied 4 times to this sample, and it took the mean value. So I really think I've said something about neuroticism in these older people. And here we see again the associations between the core signs of depression and the subsequent feelings towards God, and only the more severe types still showed a bit of association with feeling wronged by God or anxiety to God. The associations with negative religious coping persisted, even became a bit stronger. So here is my model again. There is something occurring here with things like feeling abandoned by God or spiritual alienation, that is also a term for it, and a negative coping which is not completely parallel to the negative religious representation of God. Well, there might be some state-dependent traits here, like the alienation feeling, or an existential void experience, or even perhaps a scarring effect of a severe depression or prolonged depression, and that people do not reach their initial levels of positive or coping. But that's just a hypothesis. And I think we're ready for the second question. Yes. Now, Nathan, please go.
Well, as Hanneke said, the second study was conducted with a God representation questionnaire among a group of mental health patients and non-patients. And we specifically looked using cluster analysis to see if we could find natural God image types. So with groups of people who are very similar in their scores on these different aspects that has been talked about and are different from other people. And we expected to find different profiles between patients and non-patients, because from previous research it's often been found that mental health patients have a more negative God image, which is perhaps not strange. And third, because God image is very closely related to people's personality and their self-image and the way they relate to other people. We also assessed their personality organization, which is a theoretical concept developed by Otto Kirnberg. And he basically uses 3 criteria to distinguish mental health patients along the severity of personality problems. A main one is identity diffusion, so this talks about people having a lack of an integrated self-image and black and white thinking in relation to other people. Primitive defense mechanisms is also related to this, that not having an integrated image of self and others, and therefore people with severe personality problems, they experience many problems in relationships and conflicts as well. And distorted reality testing is about people having, especially under stressful circumstances, being vulnerable to having distorted perceptions of social and sensory perceptions of reality. And as you can see, the psychotic personality organization that's distinguished by Kirnberg has distorted reality testing, obviously, is many problems with identity diffusion, primitive defense mechanisms are used. The borderline personality organization has also much problems with integrated feelings of identity and defense mechanisms, but their reality testing is much better. And lastly, the neurotic personality organization is characterized by relatively well development in these areas. And we measured personality organization using the inventory of personality organization, Dutch version, which, aside from these three main aspects, also includes low moral values and aggression. Well, there were about 300 participants, and most of them had a Christian background, so this is important to take into account when interpreting the results, the clusters, which we'll see in the next slide. There were 136 patients, with the majority of them being female, and in the non-clinical group, which consisted of 161 people, were slightly more even male than females. And the primary diagnoses were on axis 1 or axis 2, it was about average, and the study included both inpatients and outpatients. Well, this is the result of the cluster analysis. And so here you see the six subskills of the Goddard questionnaire: positive feelings, feelings of anxiety, anger, perceptions of supportive actions, perceptions of God as being ruling and punishing, and him being passive. And the interesting thing is that within both patients and non-patients, we found two clusters with profiles that were very similar. So, see the filled-in symbols, these are the patients, and the empty are the non-patients. So these are two profiles that, as you can see, are very high on positive feelings, relatively low on anger, on anxiety and anger, high on supportive actions, also quite high on ruling punishing, and low on passivity. And there's a second type of profile which is found in both patients and non-patients, which we called kind of a passive, unemotional guardian. As you can see, these two lines and these people are very high on passivity of God. And as for the other outcomes, they're all very low, especially in comparison to the other clusters. And then there's a third cluster, which is which we only found in the patient group, which is people with a negative God image. So these people are relatively low on positive feelings. They're very high on anger and anxiety. They're relatively low on supportive actions. And also, interestingly, they're high on ruling punishing, but similar to the positive God image. So that's why we called these people, we thought these people would have maybe more authoritarian interpretation of God's ruling punishing, whereas people which were also high on positive emotions and supported actions, maybe God's ruling punishing would be perceived more as authoritative. And then this slide shows the results of the discriminant analysis, which kind of looks in which way the subscales of the IPO were able to distinguish between these clusters. We included the clusters in a discriminant analysis, and we found that the highest loadings on these dysfunction that came out of the analysis was negative affect, identity diffusion, low positive affect, primitive defenses, and aggression. So you can say it's kind of a borderline personality pathology function. And at first, you can see that it mainly distinguishes between the clinical and the non-clinical cluster. So the non-patients, you can see with the sign minus, they score very low on this function, whereas patients, they all score above the center. And then thirdly, within the clinical group, the people with the negative authoritarian God image, they were again scored much higher, whereas the positive and passive God image types, they were very close on this function. I think in short, that's the results of this study.
Yes, and again, we could combine this in a model. And we could expect, in line with Arjan's study, that the patients with a negative God representation suffer more from depression or anxiety. But we should analyze the groups of patients further on these aspects. In conclusion, we could say that religion can be a source of support and positive feelings, since more than the half of our psychiatric patients had a positive type of God representation. So suffering from personality pathology or psychopathology does not necessarily imply a negative God representation. That's the good news. And this is in line with other studies. In 2013, Bennett published a review in which the same was highlighted. But at the same time, religion reflects or maybe also functions as a source of suffering, because the more severe the structural personality pathology, the more negative patients' religiousness. And I think these results show the value of a cluster approach, because we are able to differentiate between patients and show how positive and negative aspects of God representations are configured within patients, and not only the separate skills ever analyzed. When we relate these findings to the longitudinal study of depressed elders, then the parallels are remarkable. Again, the more severe the pathology, or the more unfavorable the cause of depression, the more negative a person's religiousness. And to those working with psychiatric patients, both studies show the importance of a careful examination of different aspects of religiousness, in which attention is paid to the balance or the imbalance, the relationship between positive and negative aspects of religiousness. We should like to give more conclusions, but work is still in progress and will continue.
Are there any questions? Yes, please. Go.
That was brilliant. I really enjoyed that. And I think the a couple of things put me in mind of the Japanese having got rid of schizophrenia, and now they have integration disorder. It fits with your model there of having spirituality and that disintegration as a problem. So in a way it supports that as an intervention in itself. Although you haven't demonstrated any causality there, it certainly suggests that helping people regain spiritual integration would in fact impact on those issues.
Yes, but that's two or three studies ahead.
Yes, I'm just excited by the correlations.
Yes. These are the strongest correlations I ever seen in the psychology of religion. Correlations of about 0.40, 0.50, and that continues to be the case. Okay, one other formative question. No, it's just a sort of show, and we love to be in contact with you in the future. Then we should move on and ask the other Hanneke van Kroning, this time Hanneke van Mutten, also a psychology of religion. You are now turning us to a completely different sample, different forms, dementia patients.
It's a bit surprising for myself as well. I'm always talking about spiritual care, mourning, trauma, coping, losses all over the place. But now, today I would like to draw your attention to family caregiving in the context of dementia. It's based on literature and survey study and our own ongoing research project, which method is described in a summary booklet, and I'm not going to repeat it actually the whole part. But let me start with an anecdote. First, I have to mention, of course, my colleagues. This is our site, really, pratenovergezondheid.nl. It's the same in UK, it's Health Talk Online. Maybe you know it over there. But let me start with an anecdote. Almost 15 years ago, I had the following conversation with my grandfather. He'd been taking care of my grandmother for several years, diagnosed with Alzheimer. She lived sunk in her own world, almost completely. Well, he said, to make it more easy for myself, we have ready to eat pancakes for dinner 3 times a week. I don't have to bother about cooking those days, and actually they taste very well. I can still feel my own surprise and indignation, followed by my question, but what about Grandma? She hates pancakes. Well, he replied, she's forgotten, that's it. Why? My grandfather, being dedicated to his wife, having a loving relationship, using all his skills as a craftsman to keep her home as long as possible, how could he discard her dinner preferences that easily? Well, this brings me to an important question regarding family caregiving in the sense of non-professionals taking care of vulnerable people and receiving care, of course, as well. When we should ask, is family caregiving done well? Our anecdote makes perfectly clear that part of the problem lies in the fact that different perspectives are involved. So stating that good caregiving is important and being aware of the complicated nature of giving good care, I would like to elaborate on the following subjects. Which values, and more precise, which philosophical or spiritual values dominate family caregiving in the context of dementia, and how do these values relate to good care? Well, how are we going to answer this question? First of all, from a literature and survey perspective, I will briefly discuss the construct of dementia, as well as what we know about the values involved in dementia family healthcare. Secondly, we need some information about hot political issues concerning family caregiving in the Dutch context. And finally, I will indicate what our own research findings contribute to a preliminary answer. Starting with our survey context, very briefly. Dementia nowadays is used as an umbrella term that includes about 50 different forms, among others the well-known Alzheimer's, vascular dementia, and dementia with Lewy body. But there are lots of critics. Peter Whitehouse, a well-known expert on dementia, states defining this process of brain aging as a disease and then trying to cure it is at its roots unscientific and misguided. But nevertheless, also in defining dementia as an issue of aging, complicated by cognitive challenges, caregiving in such a context remains a serious issue. After all, because of these cognitive problems involved, caregivers need to make more and more decisions on behalf of individuals with dementia, and specifically these so-called surrogate decisions show remarkable discrepancies between, on the one hand, family caregivers, and on the other hand, the individuals with dementia, especially in the field of values and preferences related to dementia care. These show a lack of concordance. So caregivers' perceptions of the importance of their relatives' daily care values and preferences simply decrease over time. Well, I was a bit relieved that my grandfather's dinners were not that exceptional. One of the explaining factors concerns quality of life. The more caregivers judge their own quality of life and well-being as negative, the less they perceive their relatives' values and preferences as important. But values in these studies were generally restricted to daily care issues, and we expect spiritual values, and those relate to one's philosophy of life, to be decisive as well. You could read the work of Swinton, for example. We move to the Dutch context, and then not back to pancakes, who are actually very popular in our country, but to healthcare politics in the Netherlands. In a nutshell, leading politicians favor the idea of a society of participation, participatie in Dutch, meaning that people should feel more responsible for themselves and their relatives and depend less on professional care. But in transferring this switch in policy to concrete measures, a remarkable gap, however, concerned precisely leading this particular home situation of family care. So the latest huge research plan in this area, the so-called Delta Plan Dementia, referring to the Dutch waterworks protecting this land, our land against floods, concentrates on prevention and palliative care, and thereby actually discarding the crucial years in between. Also worth mentioning is that research shows that family care is being experienced in the Netherlands as a heavy burden, but on the other hand also evokes feelings of fulfillment and gratefulness, which strongly relates to the wish to take care of their relatives themselves and not handing over or leaning on professionals. Let me summarize. People are forced to take more responsibility in family care. However, this duty does not automatically result in good care conditions. since dementia family caregiving is experienced as a burden as well as fulfilling, we need to know more about the different ways caregivers persevere in their caring attitude all those years, and not only in describing how they are able to do so, but also why. What motivates and supports them in hanging on? And that's precisely what our own research project aimed at. There are too much words for PowerPoint. I am to be aware of that. But you only we only outline the most important words. An interview project of the Dutch subdivision Healthdoc Online, remind again the text in our summary booklet, focused on the insider's perspectives in the context of dementia. And based on the results of another main research topic of our group in Groningen, trauma, mourning, and meaning, coping in the domain of mental health care, we definitely needed to learn more about the following topics in the caregiver's narratives, and that is, means experience losses, connected existential questions, and the existential answers to their losses and questions. And obviously the context of a specific relationship and perseverance in taking care of the topics as well. In short, our focus concerned analyzing the exact formulating and evaluating of caregivers' experiences of loss on the one hand and their personal coping strategies on the other hand in the context of their relationship. We hypothesized that by doing so we could learn about why and how different fundamental values and beliefs were experienced as more or less supporting in life. And that is important. If we shortly return to my grandmother's valuing of a proper dinner, in her case, you really should take into account how she experienced World War II, and more particularly the Hungry Winter. Access to more than enough and proper food became an important theme to her afterwards. Okay, in our project, we focus on a subgroup of interviewed caregivers whose spouses did not yet enter professional care 24 hours a day. And the following themes were used: losses, the position of the caregiver, perseverance in care, appreciation of the current experience, connectedness with the spouse with dementia, and caregivers' personal perspectives on proper or good family caregiving. Now I present to you some of our preliminary interpretive, evidence is a bit. And we are still going on with our analysis, but I will mention briefly to you the next topics. On the topic of losses, one of the significant losses concerns the caregiver's identity. Due to the losses experienced by their spouses, they seem to experience their identity being more and more reduced to their role as a caregiver. And the situation of narrow horizons is primarily evaluated as a burden, but they also mention their fulfillment and feelings of fulfillment, of gratefulness, actually. Hardly any of our respondents, however, reflected spontaneously on their ambivalence. Furthermore, the role of caregiver appears to result for some in an attitude which more or less automatically decreases personal mental room space for preferences of the other, the spouse, like mentioned in literature, while others characterize their situation the other way around. There's no room left for their own preferences and values. Second topic, perseverance in care. There seem to be at least two different perspectives, colored by, on one hand, intrinsic, on the other hand, extrinsic perspectives. An example of the first one, of course I persevere in caregiving. That's life, for better or worse. An example of the second one, it's my duty to persevere in the eyes of the outsiders, so that's what I'm doing, but it doesn't fit me at all. When we go to the third topic, the sources of support related to personal existential evaluation. As part of the valuing of caregivers' connectedness in their relationship, the widespread professional advice stresses the importance of caregivers taking care of themselves by having a life for themselves. Remarkably, our respondents evaluated togetherness in activities as the most important source of support. Enjoy the small pleasures in life together is a related motto. Other sources of support being mentioned focus on relationships of another kind in the caregiving role, that's being together still. If we try to connect this outcome with the narrowing horizons, it seems that, among other reasons, exactly the exercise in openness to others, as well as the experience openness to themselves by the other persons, contribute to hang on in their own situation. By comparing caregivers' advices to fellow caregivers with other parts of the interview concerning the factual situation, their own description about their own caregiving relationship, we assume that these advices seem to help the caregivers themselves as well, exactly by giving words to their own ideals, wishes, hoped for, and or ideal caregiving situations, and in formulating advices, they reveal glimpses of their personal whys connected to their perseverance. Thus it seems worthwhile knowing more about caregivers' life mottos. It sheds light on supportive aspects in carrying it on, as well as on the existential whys of doing so. To conclude, there we are. My reaction to my grandfather's weak menu does reveal something about my own image of good care. Not bothering about cooking certainly saved him energy he obviously needed to carry on day after day. Energy for inventing new strategies to help the spouse to keep on moving, for example, and being together as long as possible. An ambivalence we also find in literature and in our research. Caregivers' values may not only differ from their spouse's values, but also from those from outside perspective. Okay? Professional caregivers, for example. But it's worthwhile to search for them, exactly because they seem to reveal a glimpse of the fundamental existential spiritual support or motivation which keeps them going on. Obviously, these identity aspects of the caregiving role is a topic for further research, as well as the so-called professional advices. A final remark would underline that these whys of family caregiving are not that easy to be generalized. With reason, Peter Whitehouse states that if you saw one patient with Alzheimer's disease, you only saw one patient with Alzheimer's disease. And I think it's the same with caregivers. These DPEX methods, interviews, need to be complemented by personal stories, including the existential and or spiritual components. My grandmother never ever forgot to thank the Lord for her daily bread. My grandfather took over when she was not able to say these words herself anymore. So one needs the personal stories to discover how the ever-changing relationship in the context of dementia still adds to experience of burden, but experience of fulfillment as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Hanneke, for your plea for more, also including the narrative. So where would we end in Scotland then? I think we'd also use the narrative. We have time for one question, but we have also a final speaker, and we will need 5 or 10 minutes beyond five. Is it a problem for you? The buses will leave at 5:15 or something
five
like 30. That. So
5:30.
Yeah. Okay, so there will be no problem at all for the last speaker. Then, is there any question? Yes, please. Go ahead.
It's a comment, really, and it's mainly to my wife. I like pancakes.
Me too, actually.
You may forget that.
I may, and this is why I'm telling my
wife. It is an interesting example of keeping your own identity in this battle of ambivalence.
I suppose my serious point was, if I can ask, do these findings broaden out beyond your culture?
I didn't understand.
Are your findings broaden out beyond the Dutch context? What's it like in other cultures? Does this theory hold?
I did not compare the Hectic Online findings and the Dutch findings yet, because they are not all analyzed right now. But it would be interesting, I suppose. But our questions about evaluation of their relationship were added, actually. And in the Health Talk Online interviews, they weren't even there. So, yeah.
One other remark? No? Then we will change once more with the final speaker today. I'm certain you are the last speaker announced today. Hank Stil, student from the Reformed University of Zwolle. And he is working on the image of God, but in an ordinary representation of God. image of God is sort of a forbidden term by Hanukkah.
Yes, I speak of representation
you
too.
You speak of representation, yes. Okay. And just take your time. But he has a totally different method than ordinary questioners. And he will explain to us how we arise there. And this is, well, the main body of the PhD research, I think.
Yes.
Yes, okay. That's a very ancient text that you have over there.
The problem is you don't have any administrative rights to run the program.
Crazy.
Yes, I have crazy. Which doesn't show up?
No. The thing is that laptop is locked. You can't run programs.
Oh,
it is protected against.
Protected, exactly. Because the thing is, you can run presentations, but you can't run programs.
Okay, that's a problem.
Another laptop?
It's another laptop.
Yeah.
That can
you
be.
The press, yeah?
Yes, give it a try.
Just tell us.
Or you can tell.
Well, it's very efficient. Is there another? Has anyone a laptop?
This is only a laptop. I can't connect to there, so that's in the problem.
No. Yeah. I can run. I can connect the cable. If you want it.
Right. Okay.
Would be nice. One of my personal goals is to make my presentation shorter so I can practice well.
Oh yes, we keep on to help you with very, very
yes,
short.
Right.
But I think we need an adapter. Do you have an adapter by any chance?
I don't have VGA.
Oh.
We need a VGA to USB.
We can't correct that way because this is VGA.
Okay, double times.
Let me check just something, but I'm not sure if it will work out.
Can you just try to start with the principles of your study? Yes.
Let's see.
Why don't you start, eh? Because otherwise...
Yes.
I don't know how this is it.
Well, I start with an anecdote. Recently, our congregation held a special service for children, and the Reverend came into the church on his bike, and he asked the children to whom they would go when their bike was broken, and to Jesus, one of the children immediately replied. And this improbable answer is an important reason for this study. Because if, as a religious researcher, if you ask a religious person who has great difficulty keeping the head above water, whom he or she will turn to for help, then what will be the answer? There's every chance that you get the same answer to Jesus, which is probably a socially desirable answer, a confession of faith, loyalty to the doctrine. But does it actually function this way too? Undoubtedly, many religious persons turn to their God for support, but research demonstrates that especially people who as a child has an insecure attachment to their parents may have great difficulties in really experiencing this comfort and support from their God. Because next to or maybe under a conscious positive representation of the God the person believes in, there may be other, more unconscious representations of this God. Negative, fearful, malevolent representations. God as a monster, you might say. But there should be a picture of a monster. That's why I say monster. The relevance is what something changed. These representations, being unconscious, will not easily come to surface in the common research methods consisting mostly of self-report questionnaires. When asking people about the feelings they experience when they think about their God, as for example happens in the questioner God image, which is now called questioner God representation, one encounters some serious difficulties. And the most important obstacle is that this approach may be too verbal, too conceptual, and that we don't know to which extent the answers
are also informed by unconscious aspects of God representation. In the literature about God representations for 20 years, there has been a futile call for the use of other instruments to use and to study unconscious aspects of God's representations. And by conducting this study, I hope to fill the observed gap. The psychologist Todd Hall states that it can be derived from object relations theory and attachment theory that these representations have a narrative structure and that they are stored in our memory in the structure of a story. In order to investigate this narrative structure, I developed the TED-GR, which stands for Thematic Apperception Test God Representations. This instrument tries to detect a person's implicit God representations based on the stories he or she makes up about pictures that are shown to them. I therefore constructed 15 pictures with people in positive, neutral or negative situations and in non-religious or religious settings. And the participants is asked to make up a story about a picture, telling what's happening, what led up to it, and how it ends. And to pay attention to the thoughts and feelings of the people, to the thoughts and feelings of God, and to acts of God and his reasons for them, for what he's doing. Respondents are told that the pictures are about people dealing with God and God interacting with people. To give you an impression of what is scored by the instrument, I shortly go over its scales. First scale is complexity of the representation of God. So what is said about God? How simple and one-dimensional, or how complex and integrated is he described? The second scale concerns the affect tone of the relationship with God. What are the feelings of the character regarding his relationship with God? Are these feelings negative, mixed, neutral, or positive? And the third scale addresses the emotional investment in the relationship with God. What seems the most important reason for the character to relate to God? Does selfish fulfillment of his own needs prevail, or can we talk of a mature, reciprocal, devoted relation? A related scale concerns coping with religious demands. Does the character have fear of punishment, ritual obedience, or can we talk of identification with constituting norms and values? The next scale concerns someone's vision on the agency of God. Is God passive, or does he have impact on and intentions with what happens in the story? And the last scale addresses the attachment to God. This scale tries to determine to which extent we can speak of an anxious or avoidant attachment or a secure attachment to God by checking if in the stories, in case of danger, the character is expecting help from God and experiencing it, or in case there's no danger, if the subject is or the character is experienced as a secure base. Well, main question is, if this instrument compared with self-report instruments really can detect the more unconscious aspects of God representations, I investigate this on basis of scores of 70 Christian young adults without psychiatric problems and 70 Christian psychiatric patients diagnosed with a personality or mostly anxiety disorder. And the patients are measured twice, once at the beginning and once at the end of their mostly 1 year long treatment. And the analysis regards reliability, convergent and divergent validity, and predictive validity. I very shortly go over some results which I can't show, so it's a little bit difficult to communicate, I think. Because it's a complex scoring of the scales,
I must prove that this can be done objectively by two independent scores. So I must measure an inter-racial reliability and compute an ICC interclass correlation coefficient for the scales. And well, the scores are some couples. I train my students to score, and some students are good, and they score good. 4 or 5 out of 7 couples have good or excellent ICC scores, but I have also couples that score bad. But then I know it can be done. The scales, the rules can be applied well, and I can reach high inter-rater reliability scores. Yes? But there are also a few scales that no couple or one or two couples scores high or excellent. So that's a cue that I should work on that scale. So I should, and I have already done that. I adjusted them, I reformulated them, I made the criteria different, and I added examples to the scales, and I have a new couples this year that have scored and overscore the old protocols, but I must wait what the results are, because they aren't far enough. But I have on one scale a testament to God the scores, because one couple has already finished them and can graduate in time. And the others are still sweating on it. Okay. I think that's the most important information at this time, and I have very preliminary computed some correlations with instruments that are theoretically related to this representations of God. And well, you see that in the normal group, in the non-patient group, there are correlations between these God representation measures and personality measures, well-being measures, but some correlations disappear with the patient group, which is interesting, but I can't explain why. There happens something, and there's also another movement, it seems, and some correlations which are less in the non-patient group become stronger in the patient group. And that is happening as well for my new instrument, my reactive instrument and measures, as it is for the questionnaire God image, the self-report question. There's only two instruments that correlate stronger with the patient group. Well, I think I should end it with that. And well, maybe there's time for some questions. Yes? Thank you for your attention.
I think we should applaud again for a very clear presentation without any help. Are there questions? We want to know more details, of course. But is there a question? Yes?
It's just
you. Yes.
Okay. I was very interested in an early question. Sorry. It's the inter-rater reliability is quite interesting, the way you describe it, that some people are better at it than others, aren't they? Which suggests that it's not necessarily an objective measure at all. So,
well,
the inter-rater reliability is quite interesting. So I'd quite like to hear a bit more about that, because I suppose the idea is that the scale is objective if two people, you know, give it the same score.
Yes.
And what you're saying is some people are much better at this than others.
Yes. And
I suggest a subjective component in it.
No, because if you would children do it, you would expect them to to get to the same score. So it has to do with a sort of
I think
skill.
It's rather skillful, and you have to be able to think abstract very well. And some students sign in for the project, and I have to do it with them. And I can during the training, I already feel and see that they don't get it.
Yeah.
But they have to do their research. Yeah. So then that's my last that I have to take.
Yeah.
And then the next year, I hope there will be better students. And eventually, yes.
Is there another question? I have one more question about the patient group.
Yes.
Which of the findings or correlations, can you specify it a bit, which one was the most prominent or the one that surprised you most?
Well, I must do it on behalf of being wrong, but I without the sheets, I think that the Bori, Bell's Object Relation Inventory, is the one that came out as having the most strong associations in the patient group with my instrument, with the attachment scale of my instrument, and that's the only scores I have, and a well-being outcome measurement, the OQ45-2. That were the two measures that correlated strongest in the patient group,
yes,
and which the QGI didn't. So a very preliminary conclusion is that maybe the attachment scales measure some aspects of card representations that are not measured by self-reported
expressions. Yes.
And that's what I hope I
yes. On all qualities, positive, negative, got image representations, was it?
I think there was one or two scales that correlated very likely with one OQ scale, one Bori
yes.
scale, but the card representation scales were much more.
The TAT scales.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we will see what more comes out, but thank you very much again.